Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just making life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe using iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. Today I talk to Dr. Francesco Leary, Chair of the Department of Psychology at the University of Guelph. Dr. Leary's area of expertise is fairly apt given the present health crisis involving the rise of deaths related to the use of various opioid and fentanyl drugs. Dr. Leary studies addiction, relapse, and how the brain learns and adapts to new behaviors, which is a long-winded way of saying he studies how we get hooked, biologically speaking. The brain is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, you may have heard there is an opioid crisis right now, although not as bad as it is in the United States. Ontario is tackling this very serious issue as well. Every 10 hours, someone in Ontario dies of an opioid overdose, and according to Wellington Dufferin Guelph Public Health, there were 30 opioid-related deaths in a three-year period between July 2013 and June 2016. Eric Hoskins, the Minister of Health and Long-Term Care, said in December, "Every life lost to this opioid crisis is an avoidable tragedy. Our government is committed to using every tool available to save lives and help communities grappling with this crisis." One of those tools, I think, is probably better understanding how and why the brain gets addicted in the first place. And as luck would have it, there's someone doing that research at the University of Guelph. Dr. Leary is a graduate of McGill and Concordia, and now he teaches and does research at the U of G in the College of Social and Applied Human Sciences. His area of expertise is in behavioral pharmacology and neuroscience. Specifically, and I'm quoting here, he investigates psychological and neuropharmacological mechanisms involved in the development, persistence, and recurrence of behaviors reinforced by chemical and natural rewards. In layman's terms, he studies how behavior and biology teaches our brains to get addicted, and not just addicted to drugs like heroin and cocaine and opioids, but addicted to things like sugar or even extreme behaviors like thrill-seeking or extreme sports. Now, obviously, Dr. Leary does not yet have an answer to undoing addictive behavior, nor is there likely to be a, quote, magic bullet, as he says, because the mechanisms of addiction are different in everyone. Still, Dr. Leary's research is a fascinating new doorway into thinking about addiction and our struggles with addiction. Why is it that some people can have a glass of wine with dinner every night and others become alcoholics? How can some people use opioids for their pain management after surgery and then leave them be, while otherwise healthy people take them to feel better when there's nothing physically wrong with them? So this week on the Guelph Politicast, I talked to Dr. Leary about his research and how it might play a role in developing public and health policy in response to addiction treatment. We also talk about how his research might change the way we currently understand addiction as a disease and whether or not we're training ourselves to be addicts from a young age thanks to a diet high in sugar. And we talk about whether or not human beings are just hardwired to be addicts. This is kind of a technical discussion, but one I think might be highly informative as we struggle with one of the biggest health issues of our time. So I caught up with Dr. Leary last week in studio. Francesco Leary, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with, I have up on my computer screen here your expert page on the university's media page. So, yeah. So we can explain to everyone where you are coming from, research-wise. Mm-hmm. It lists three things you focus on, mm-hmm. And I'll somewhat quote it. The first one is neurobiological mechanisms involved in the reacquisition of drug-seeking behavior, mm-hmm. learning processes central to drug relapse. Mm-hmm. So what that sounds like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not mm-hmm. a scientist, so. But it sounds like this is dealing with how and why the brain, how people who are addicted to drugs will find themselves back into those familiar patterns despite the fact of, you know, rehabilitation and all that hard work, all that effort to stop the addiction.
Yeah, and this is at the level of behavioral habits mm-hmm. and the learning patterns. So the research is done in animal models of drug taking and drug seeking, so that we really focus on the most biological aspects of these predispositions and these habits rather than the cognitive and you know, more human aspects of relapse that go beyond these biological predispositions, I guess, and learned contingencies and environmental triggers, all those kind of things that we can study in models, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Right, because there's three factors in just about any behavior, right? There's what we're biologically predetermined to do, what we're psychologically predetermined to do, and what we're, like, situationally predetermined to do, what the environment we're exposed to.
Yeah. I'm not sure if we're predetermined to do, but the way we do it in the lab and in the environment, there are stimuli that are very, very strong in promoting learning and in promoting the formation of habits. And drugs of abuse are among these stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
So given the right situation, it doesn't really matter what kind of organism you're studying. Mm. You will get profound changes in behavior and reliable learning of actions and of associations when these stimuli are introduced.
It's a perfect storm.
It's a perfect storm, and it can be observed in a variety of species. Of course, the behavior which we measure is different, and the consequences of the behavior will be very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are interested in how the brain works to underline these processes and what are the environmental triggers that can turn it on and off, and what are the pathways in the brain and the pharmacology of that, then it really doesn't matter what the species is.
Mm-hmm. Your second area of focus, studying the behavioral effects of exposure to drugs of abuse, which specific emphasis on modulation of learning, memory, and reward-seeking behaviors,
right.
Which sounds like how we kind of, you use a drug and how the brain sort of rearranges itself to be about seeking that constant high again.
Yeah, and this is directly relevant to relapse.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, the problem with drug addiction is obviously taking the drugs, yes, but if anytime you want to stop, you stop and everything is fine, then it wouldn't be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that these are relapsing disorders. Many psychiatric conditions are relapsing disorders. So understanding the memory processes behind these disorders is key to understand why they're so permanent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why relapse is the application, but the underlying focus is on why are they remembered so well.
Mm-hmm. And then your third area of focus of your research is the comorbidity, which a word I had to look up,
right.
Between mood disorders and vulnerability to drug and food addictions.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like there's kind of the same way, and we'll get to the some of the specific, because I did read an article you wrote about with particular emphasis on high fructose sugar, but there's the brain doesn't distinguish whether you get addicted to something like cocaine and get addicted to something like sugar.
Yeah, you got it right. That's pretty much that. You know, in the pop culture and even in some branches of medicine, I guess people talk about addictive personality. We're not talking about personality here, but what we're talking about is alteration of a common system of learning and memory that is highly sensitive to powerful reinforcers. And that it doesn't matter what the reinforcer is, and it doesn't have to be even a drug. It doesn't have to be food. It could be particular type of sensory stimulations, like gambling and those kind of things.
Adrenaline rush.
Yeah, a collection of. I'm actually talking about something that's in the environment more so than our response. What's in the environment? You know, something novel, something that is attracts a lot of attention. That is stimulating. You know, so those stimuli are processed in the brain through common pathways. So in that sense, there will be a commonality between all behaviors that are motivated by these strong reinforcers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The pathways, they're in common.
One of the things sort of digging into your research, and again, I'm not a scientist, so some of it goes above my head, but some of the stuff I did get out of it, it got me thinking, you know, we've come to, and I think it's sort of a common, in terms of the lay culture, that, you know, addiction is a disease.
Mm-hmm.
what your research seemed to indicate, at least from my reading, was that it is also a learned behavior. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about the, you know, you can, when you, we think of disease, we think of something you can't help but catch. You know, you know, something like the flu, let's say.
Yeah.
But when we think of the way you're talking about addiction is, mm-hmm. you're also teaching your body how to become addicted, whether you're aware of that or not.
Well, I guess that's where the, you're absolutely right. But that's probably where the difference is.
Mm.
You're right, is whether you're aware or not.
Mm.
I think that's where the distinction is.
Mm-hmm.
And I can think about a variety of psychopathologies that will erode your ability to be aware of it, like schizophrenia, for example,
right?
Or mood disorders like a severe depression. In those kind of situations, you're not very focused on what other aspects of your mind are doing, assuming that. We believe in the concept, and certainly, why not?
Mm-hmm.
We believe in the concept of mind. But in other situations, it is more of an escalation. In fact, I would say that a large, just think about typical alcohol dependence. Alcohol dependence. This is something that, for the majority of the dependents, the average age of dependence, 45 years old. So... Now, of course, there will be people that will develop severe problems with alcohol very, very early in life, and they will keep that for forever, really. But most that develop major problems with alcohol do so later in life.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably don't lose their ability to be aware of their actions.
Right.
It's something that is built. It's built slowly over years, habits that are acquired, that become stronger. And stronger and stronger, and at some point there may be a switch,
right?
And I'm not really sure if the concept of switch is meaningful, because something that happens over 30 years, where is the switch? It's
right.
Probably not a very useful metaphor to use,
right?
But there is a point where the body is actually telling you it's enough,
right?
And that's where the unawareness comes in.
Mm.
You don't listen to that.
That's interesting, because. Yeah. Something like heroin,
mm-hmm.
Your body will, correct me if I'm wrong, but heroin, your body is something that's really difficult to get addicted to, because your body recognizes this as something it does not want any part of.
Yes, indeed. And any addiction requires training, believe
right.
it or not. I mean, and
that's a weird way to put it, but yeah.
It's a weird way to put it, but I think that this is the benefit of using rats in the work. I mean, rats don't drink alcohol.
No.
Rats dislike alcohol profoundly, unless you have particular species and particular, you know, genetic backgrounds. But most outbred rats don't drink alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But if you train them,
mm-hmm.
and if you do the right thing, then they will. Usually, you have to mix them with sugar.
Mm.
Have them expose them to sugar, more sugar, more alcohol, and then all of a sudden, you can remove the sugar and the alcohol consumption stay elevated.
Mm.
Now think about what happens to us.
Right.
I mean, people, we're not born with the pleasure of enjoying a beautiful Beaujolais on the hills of France. Hey, you know, the most experience that we have with any alcohol is like, it's gross, it's disgusting.
Right.
But then we get trained. Society trains us, our friends trains us, our parents trains us. What
right.
we see in TV trains us. University, of course, trains us. You know? And then all of a sudden, we become beer connoisseurs. We make our own beer. We make our own wine. We
right.
start distinguishing between spirits and what kind of oaks they were distilled or whatever, you know? Like, so it's definitely an acquired taste
right.
and an acquired habit. The right. taste itself changes, of course, because from aversive, it becomes pleasurable, and that can be studied. And the habit, at mm-hmm. first, is an occasional thing, and then it becomes much more regular, and then you have the issues with the pharmacology of the substances.
Right.
Then you have the dependence component, the withdrawal component, and then that kicks in on top of the habits.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then this doesn't always end in alcoholism, though.
No.
You can... It doesn't, you'd have a glass of wine with dinner and be satisfied. Some people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, that's what we consider to be the norm. But what we fail to, you know, to usually think about, that the from a point of heroin use, there is a lot of people that also don't get in trouble with heroin and that they use it on a regular basis. They're called chippers. And it's a sizable number of opiate users are chippers.
Right.
Yeah. So the concept, I think that it's a common concept. These stimuli can be used in moderation.
Mm-hmm.
They can be controlled.
Right.
Many people can do that. But what's common is that the danger of losing the control, it's always there.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and I'm not trying to be or make a big deal, but the reality is that it's almost being a little mouse and you're eating the cheese around the strap.
Right.
You're eating it. You may eat it all your life and be happy. You got enough cheese and nothing ever happened. But in the proper situation with the proper perfect storm, if you want to call it that way, whether it is genetic predispositions, whether it is environmental stressors, of course, that will play a big role in our lives, that trap will snap.
Right.
And then you find yourself on the other side.
Mm, that's a chilling way of putting it. Mm-hmm. You brought up sugar, how you've used sugar to help get rats used to the taste of alcohol.
Yeah, sure.
And of course, I did mention this a couple of minutes ago, but you have written a paper that ties sort of directly that because there's so much high fructose sugar in the modern diet, that we are also kind of training ourselves inadvertently to become susceptible to other types of addiction later on in life. And so that's kind of frightening because we don't, although, you know, we do talk about food addiction and we do are aware of the effects of that type of sugar on negative health.
Sure.
We don't draw a straight line between the two.
No, and you know, there is a straight line you can draw from a point of view of brain systems, and that straight line may not be that straight when you put the brain system in a brain of a person in a society, you know. So it's just important to realize that because there is a biological correspondence, it's not 100% for sure. That it's not surprising. It's not surprising. I'm definitely not the first one to make this kind of parallels. And you know, there are so many ways in which you can verify this and think about it. Like many psycho pharmacological treatments that are employed to deal with psychiatric conditions, maybe depression, for example. Yes, they're antidepressants, but they affect other aspects of the hedonic functioning of somebody.
Right.
They will have side effects on nutrition.
Right.
They will have side effects on sexuality.
Mm.
In some cases, depending on the compounds, they will have side effects on gambling tendencies. I mean, there is a famous case of these drugs are used for treating Parkinson, and these people, as soon as they get on Parkinson, they start to become compulsive. Now, what's interesting, though, this is one interesting that made me think about Italians, that have experienced these compulsions, end up doing a lot of shopping.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they become shopaholics or whatever you want to say. And while British become gamblers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that it makes you a gambler or somebody that shops more. It just gives you a predisposition to be more sensitive to what's culturally fitting.
Right.
In your environment, it turns out that in this particular comparison, I guess Italians have more shops around than casinos, and
right.
You know,
you find an outlet for it.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a generalized tendency. So that's what I'm saying.
Right.
That's what we're discussing. It's generalized. One drugs and change the way you respond to another, and so on.
I wonder though, because we have. In the culture, a debate about whether or not to tax sugar, and I know there are some political parties that want to make that a platform that you know, maybe treat it as like a sin tax, as akin to cigarettes or alcohol.
Yeah.
Does that seem viable?
Oh, like, yeah. Some countries are doing that effectively. Yeah. Why not?
Okay. So it's curious that, you know, the Twinkie defense, it almost seems like there's almost a scientific basis for that now, that if
well, look, if I'm a government and I want to make money, right, I will tax something that people are more likely to buy, even though right, they're taxed. And then sugars and fats and those kind of stuff, you know that they will be consumed at some point. You know, there is a demand for those products. So,
right,
in fact, you know, in psychology, this issue of changing the price of a particular item and establish how much people will pay for that, it's an indication of the incentive properties of that particular stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you can change in a lab,
right,
to establish how strong the person is driven toward those stimuli, regardless of what they say. You know, they say, yeah, I don't really care about this, I don't like it, I don't want it, but then they spend money.
Right.
That's your index, you know.
Right. I mean, but that is sort of a practical consideration,
yeah,
coming out of your research. And I am curious about that because we, of course, are dealing with a crisis in,
yeah,
Ontario communities involving opioids and yeah, fentanyl addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I know it's not particularly what you're focused on, but in terms of understanding our, you know, how the brain functions in terms of addiction,
mm-hmm,
How do you think that translates into the real world application? How does understanding the brain help addicts out here in the real world?
Well, there are so many ways, including treatment, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the, you know, these things are cyclical,
right?
They come and they go. They come and they go. And they come and they go. And sometimes it's not about whether they're there or not there. Is whether we're paying attention or not paying attention.
Yeah.
So traditionally, Ontario has never been a heroin type of environment. It's
right,
always been a prescription environment.
Mm.
But the opioids problems, we always had it. Now, I cannot, you know, so that's one element. At West, it has been mostly an heroin problem.
Right.
At the same time of history, put it this way, right? There's always been more heroin there because of the Pacific imports and so on. So that's one thing. The second thing is the market, how the market changes on these illicit drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these fentanyl-like compounds are definitely newer. When you make any drug easier to take and more potent,
mm-hmm,
now you start to reveal different type of problems.
Right.
So if somebody's offered heroin where you have to take, mix it, and inject it,
right,
that's one thing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it takes a certain level of commitment to trying that drug.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. If on the other hand says, well, look, drink some of the syrup or take this pill, that's a different level of commitment.
Right.
Much easier to do. So and then there is a component of how potent that compound is.
Mm.
Now, opioids are a class of compounds that they can be very, very lipid solubles. There are some forms of synthetic opioids that a little drop on your skin,
mm-hmm,
it goes through membranes so easily that will go through your skin, get to your bloodstream, and get to your brain and be enough to produce an overdose. The lab where I was working as a graduate student, my supervisor used to tell me stories about in his own lab they were making different opioids, synthetic opioids. You know, that's what the lab did, and he said in every room, every office, they used to have naltrexone,
right?
Because in some cases they create compounds that they were so dangerous that very small amounts that would just touch the skin will be enough to produce an overdose. So they would have to make sure that they had the antidote available,
right,
to prevent.
In case of accident,
but just in the lab, you know. So then what's going on is that these compounds are getting created,
mm-hmm,
and they're getting sold.
Mm.
They're extremely powerful. They're easy to transport. You can detect them. And just one enjoyment, let me try this, it's enough.
Right.
It's enough to kill somebody.
There's so many stories like that. Like of course, one time,
boom. Yeah. So it's not really the fentanyl crisis. Is the dangerous, very strong opioids that can be anywhere, and that people are not aware of, and they have no idea. Nobody really knows how to dose this thing anyway. And one snuff, boom, done.
It almost seems like, from what you're describing, it's almost like there's been a bit of irresponsibility on the part of the drug manufacturers that, and you know, not to draw a firm criminal accusation, but in trying to make things more potent, easier to take, we've kind of created the monster on the other end.
Yeah, you certainly can look at it that way, but let's talk about my father that died with cancer last year.
Right.
He was in Spain, and when the tumor started to expand to his spinal cord, he was in horrible pain.
Mm-hmm.
So in the hospital where he was, they were very aggressive on pain treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so they gave him fentanyl patches,
mm-hmm.
fentanyl lollipops, fentanyl suppositories, any way that you can possibly get it into the body, fentanyl will be able to do that.
Right.
My father had relief.
Sure.
My father was like, I cannot sleep at night. I just take a lollipop. I'm fine. He traveled to Italy to go get some treatments. And he says, I'm going to be okay as long as I can have my lollipops with me on the plane.
Right.
When he arrived in Italy, they don't have the same culture of medical or how to deal with pain.
Okay.
They immediately stop fentanyl and they put him on morphine, which is another opioid, but has a different pharmacology in a sense. You know?
Sure.
His pain was not controlled.
Mm-hmm.
He almost has seizures because of the pain.
Mm-hmm.
So I will not criticize the makers of fentanyl because they produce products that are absolutely necessary for the treatment of some type of pain and some type of patients.
Right.
They're not, that the criminality is not in that.
No.
The criminality is in how these things are prescribed when they're poorly prescribed.
Right.
And the criminality is that these compounds can be synthesized, can be made by anybody that has any understanding of chemistry. They can be done in a basement somewhere in some country.
Yeah.
And then sold.
Right.
So it's not necessarily in the hands of the pharmaceutical companies nor the medical system that creates them to treat people that need them.
Right. No, I think you're right about that, and I'm not sure. I don't think there's like a singular villain to slay here, but I mean, it does seem like there's the proper application of these drugs, from which your father received good treatment from, and then there's gray area,
That's
and then we have people dying.
That's right.
You know, one person dying every 10 hours
That's
from
right.
opioids or fentanyl.
That's right.
in the province.
But then let me ask you: how many people die from alcohol every ten hours?
Well, that's true too.
Or cigarettes.
Sure.
So I'm not saying that the opioid problem is not a problem. Quite the opposite, a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, having your son going to school, never taking drugs, takes drugs once and they die is tragic.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way of putting that on. There is no way alternative to that.
Mm-hmm.
But let's think, when we try to find the cause of that, where is the cause?
Right.
And I will argue with you that one cause of that is that in our culture, we think that drugs are fine.
Mm.
Because alcohol is fine. Yeah, you can have alcohol, no problem. You say yourself, most people have alcohol, no problem. So if you believe that,
mm-hmm.
then somebody can say, I can take one pill, no problem.
Right.
Well, why not? Why not?
Yeah.
Now, you can, but what's the alternative to that? I mean, we have to be realistic. Well, no, they're all terrible. You're going to die no matter what. That's not possible either.
Mm-hmm.
So I honestly don't have a solution. I don't have an answer to that.
Right.
I don't have an answer, but I can at least look at it overall and say, yes, but we also have a major problem with alcohol. I mean, even on campus, we know what happens.
Sure.
We know what that means, and we may not even see the problems now. We will see them in 20 years from now, these people that are here now with us.
Right, and because I think there's studies, and you are well aware of them, that of, you know, even people aged 18, 19, 20 are still, their brain chemistry is still developing.
Oh, yeah.
They are still developing physically, so it's the effects are long-term, even if they are not immediately seen. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you this, and it's kind of philosophical, but it is based on your research. Are humans built to be addicted?
Well, I think that's we're using the term addiction in a very liberal way.
Sure.
So the way I think about addiction, when I think about addiction, is when you are in the situations where you know that what you're doing has negative consequences, but you can't help.
Right.
I think that's the key element. It's this concept that I know that I'm doing something I shouldn't be doing, but I keep doing it nevertheless.
Right.
Whether it's because it's killing me, whether it's killing my relationships, whether it's taking me to jail, I'm losing my job. That's addiction. It's not the consumption itself.
Okay.
So now the question is, are we predisposed to be sensitive to this stimuli? Yes, we are. That's what our brain, you know, our brains allow us to learn when there's something meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what we do. We're machines that detect meaningful things in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And when they are meaningful in a positive way, we find ways of repeating that. When they're meaningful in the opposite way, we find ways, we develop behaviors to avoid them. And then we learn about predictors of those meaningful things. That's pretty much what we do. We find them, and then we learn how to navigate the predictors, and we approach predictors that take us to the meaningful stimulus, and we stay away from predictors of an aversive stimulus. At the very core, I'm saying, of the basic kind. So in that sense, yes. Now, well, is that what addiction is? Well, addiction is taking that to an higher level where the consumption starts to become very much focused. All the things are lost, all the interests are lost, and then you have these negative consequences that you were aware of, but you cannot help.
Right. What it sounds like is that repairing addiction, mm-hmm. and in terms of the way you described it, mm-hmm. this is going to be a multidisciplinary resolution. It's not going to be talking to a therapist or an addiction counselor, but it's also going to be talking to your doctor and biologist and geneticists. And
you're right. And the path that you need to take will be different from different people.
Right.
There is no magic bullet. There is different approaches, and some approaches are very useful for some, and completely ineffective for others, which is true for all forms of psychopathologies. Addiction is no different from depression or for bipolar disorder or from anxiety disorders. We know the general ideas of what can be useful, but just going back to what we described, so the 12 steps program is really based on the idea that addiction is a disease.
Right.
I mean, they go hand in hand. You're not responsible. That's the first step. You're not responsible. And that helps millions of people, I guess, worldwide, that approach. And not only for drugs, it's the same type of approach for gambling, the same approach. And the key element is that it can be interpreted in many different ways.
Right.
But it's based on this idea of disease. There are other people for that concept, it doesn't help them. What helps them is to realize that it's not a disease, but it's a choice.
Right.
For some people, don't get me wrong here, I'm not saying that the 12 steps is wrong, quite the opposite. I'm saying it's very useful when that's what you need. Mm-hmm. There are some other people that need a different approach. They need to say, no. My habit is based on a belief.
Right.
It's in my own belief. And I need to start thinking about my belief. Change my belief. Once I change that, then everything else will get in order. But I need to be able to have that insight and also the ability on think about what my beliefs are. So, and, you know, depending on where you are in life, what kind of stages, what kind of experiences you had, you may not do that, or if you do that, but there's something else and you need another approach to each one its own.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the only way. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. So where does your where does your research go from here, and what are you working on now on this issue?
Well, we are taking everything that we've learned from the point we're using our knowledge of learning and our knowledge about these reinforcers and incentives in our life, whether it's drugs or whether it's sugars, whether it's social contact being of, you know, there's a right novelty, and we're using them in the context of either what they do on memory formation. So I'm still after the same questions. I didn't stop. I'm still doing the same thing. No, this never ends. Because, you know, I can look at different aspects of memory formation, different systems. Mm-hmm. We can look at, we're looking at how different brain systems interact for those kind of memory effects or learning effects. Or now we're looking in the context of pharmacological treatments that are used for depression.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at that and individual vulnerabilities to learn about aversive stimuli in different dimensions that makes you more or less vulnerable to be exposed to stress. And but at the bottom, we're reusing and relooking always at the same thing: powerful environmental stimuli incentives, aversive stimuli, learning processes, memory processes, and basic pharmacology.
Well, I've been very stimulated by this conversation.
Okay.
So, Professor Leary, thank you so much for lending your expertise today.
Anytime.
And once again, that was Dr. Francesco Leary of the University of Guelph. You can find the article we mentioned, Sugar in the Diet May Increase Risks of Opioid Addiction, at conversation.com. You can also find out more about the Province of Ontario's strategy to prevent opioid addiction and overdose at the website for the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care at health.gov.on. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. For the music for the Guelph Politicast, you can go to KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can visit the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.